Awesome. Well, it's great to see everybody here today. There's lots of new faces that I don't know, but you're very welcome here. I'm just going to start by reading the passage. As Clint said, it's Mark chapter 6, starting with verse 30 and then going to verse 52. And it's a story that I'm pretty sure a lot of you will have heard before. It's like a classic Sunday school story, but it's great. The apostles returned to Jesus and told him all that they had done and taught. And he said to them, "Come away by yourselves to a desolate place and rest a while." For many were coming and going, and they had no leisure even to eat. And they went away in the boat to a desolate place by themselves. Now many saw them going and recognized them, and they ran there on foot from all the towns and got there ahead of them. When he went ashore, he saw a great crowd, and he had compassion on them, because they were like sheep without a shepherd. And he began to teach them many things. And when it grew late, his disciples came to him and said, "This is a desolate place, and the hour is now late. Send them away to go into the surrounding countryside and villages and buy themselves something to eat." But he answered them, "You give them something to eat." And they said to him, "Shall we go and buy 200 denarii worth of bread and give it to them to eat?" And he said to them, "How many loaves do you have? Go and see." And when they had found out, they said, "Five and two fish." Then he commanded them all to sit down in groups on the green grass. So they sat down in groups by hundreds and by fifties. And taking the five loaves and the two fish, he looked up to heaven and said a blessing, and broke the loaves and gave them to the disciples to set before the people. And he divided the two fish among them all. And they all ate and were satisfied. And they took up 12 baskets full of broken pieces and of the fish. And those who ate the loaves were 5,000 men. Immediately he made the disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side, to Bethsaida, while he dismissed the crowd. And after he had taken leave of them, he went up on the mountain to pray. And when evening came, the boat was out on the sea, and he was alone on the land. And he saw that they were making headway painfully, for the wind was against them. And about the fourth watch of the night, he came to them, walking on the sea. He meant to pass by them, but when they saw him walking on the sea, they thought it was a ghost and cried out, for they all saw him and were terrified. But immediately he spoke to them and said, "Take heart, it is I. Don't be afraid." And he got into the boat with them, and the wind ceased. And they were utterly astounded, for they did not understand about the loaves, but their hearts were hardened. Will you pray with me? Jesus, I thank you for your word, and I thank you that you are present with us today, and that you want to speak to us and meet us in this story and in this text. And I pray that you would take what I have, the small amount that I have to bring, and I pray that you would take that and use that to feed us this morning. Feed us, your people. We're hungry to hear your word, Lord. Amen. All right, so, like many of you, I imagine, I really enjoy watching movies. But I'm also one of those people that actually really likes analysing them as well. Slightly annoying to some people, but I really like thinking about the way that the director has chosen to tell the story. Do I have any other common, you know, like literary nerds around? Yeah, okay, it's really fun to like analyze what's going on, how the director's telling the story. And one of my favorite techniques is when the story is told as a flashback. You know, when like the director chooses to start with a particular scene and it raises all these questions, you're like, what's going on? Who are these people? What's happening? And then it like sets up a situation, and then the movie goes back in time and like tells the story of how they got to that particular scene or to that particular point. And I was trying to think of a really compelling, like recent example, but I don't get to go to the movies very much. So all I could think about was that classic sports movie, Remember the Titans. Has anyone seen Remember the Titans? Yeah, okay, it goes back a wee way, never mind. Good things, it can be old. Now, the Remember the Titans begins with sort of kind of somber, stirring music. And it begins with a mixed group of black and white Americans arriving in cars and then walking together. They walk very much like as this big group, really slowly and really steadily. And you're sort of instantly drawn into thinking about, okay, what's happening here? Who are these people? Why have they come together? And why this obvious emotion? It's a really emotional scene. And then the voiceover like takes us back 10 years earlier to the story that led them up to that event or that particular moment, which turned out to be a funeral. No big spoilers there. Why does the director do this? And I think the director wants to throw emphasis on a particular moment, right? A key turning point that illustrates something really important. And in this case, with the movie, it was like changed race relations in a small American town. Why do I start with this? It's because today, as we look at this passage, I'd like us to imagine that it's been made into a movie. Or, if you prefer, and this is probably going to hit more people, it's an episode on a show called Mark's Mystery that you can binge watch on Netflix. And so if it is this like this show on Netflix, this is the opening scene, okay, this particular episode. Now, the opening scene is actually the end scene, but we don't know that yet. And it goes like this. So you kind of have to like just humor me. Close your eyes. Imagine that this is what you're watching on the screen. I'm going to be a screenwriter for a minute. There's a rough sea in the dark of the night. We hear the sound of wind and waves crashing against the side of a small boat. We hear the grunts and groans of a group of weary men pulling at the oars. Then the camera does a slow pan of the men's pained faces. We see who these men are. We see their struggle against the elements, okay? Suddenly, there's a look of terror across the men's faces as one by one, they're gripping each other's arms and they're like crying out in fear. They're pointing in fright. But the director holds this moment. We don't know what they've seen. Suddenly, there's the reveal. There's a figure coming through the mist, looking as if it's walking on water. The men, we see them again, they're recoiling, they're shouting out, "It's a ghost!" Then the sound of a voice calling, "Don't be afraid! It's me! Take courage!" And the figure, turns out as a man, climbs into the boat, and immediately, the director shows us, the surroundings grow calm. The sound of the wind and the waves just dies right out. And we're left with the sound of idle oars slapping on the water and the men's heavy breathing. Now, just when you think the director might want to like do a big zoom in on the figure that's just been walking on the water, right? Like, who is this person that's just like done this amazing thing and they thought that he was a ghost? Who is it? Mm-mm. The director's actually not interested in showing us this person just yet. The director does this thing where he pans again the faces of the men on the boat. It's like the director wants to say, pay attention to how they are responding. Watch closely how they react to what has just happened. And what we notice in the scene is that they look astounded and blank. They're not looking like relieved or happy. They're like, oh, cool, the wind stopped. They're not bowing down in worship and awe going, this is amazing, you are amazing, wow, how did that happen? No, the look on their faces is hard and disbelieving. A couple of them like shake their head. They're looking at each other. They have questions written all over their faces. This is not quite the response that we thought we might see. One or two of them are like muttering something. And then the camera kind of slowly zooms out again. We get this kind of like long shot of the boat looking small in the middle of the sea and a great distance from shore. It's like they've got a long way to go. And then the director fades out. Now, in a similar way, when Mark tells the story in Mark 6, 45 to 52, he closes his scene not with a focus on the majesty of Jesus, who is the one who has just demonstrated incredible power over the elements. He's shown that he has control over the wind and the waves, and he can walk on water. No, Mark closes with a comment about the disciples. And it's a comment that really stands out from what's gone before. And it tells us, pay attention here. Pay attention to this. This is the important thing. And Mark tells us that the disciples were utterly astounded, for they did not understand about the loaves, but their hearts were hardened. Now, it's not actually the first time that Mark has used this phrase about hardened hearts. The hardening of people's hearts in response to Jesus has actually been a theme that's been introduced earlier. If you were here a few weeks ago, Andrew talked from Mark chapter 3 about the hardened hearts of the Jewish leaders and how those that opposed to Jesus were really hard towards him. But this is the first time that this comment has been applied to his disciples. These are those who are closest to him. These are his friends, his followers, those who have been with him the whole time. These are the ones whose hearts are hardened. What's going on here? Well, Mark is actually striking a theme that's going to grow stronger over the next couple of chapters. This theme of the disciples being the ones that don't get it. Their misunderstanding and their lack of faith. And just like the opening scene of a movie or a show, like, might raise questions and make you think, huh, what's gone on before this? Like, what's happening? So this scenario raises questions for us. What is it that the disciples didn't understand about the loaves? And why were their hearts hardened? Like, why did they respond as they did? And this is where I think we need the flashback. We need to go back in time, just like the film director, to, not 10 years earlier, but the start of the day before. What were the events preceding this that led the disciples to have hardened hearts? And I think what we'll find is that the disciples actually had a pretty hard day at the office with Jesus. It's not their best day. And I'm wondering, as we read about it, if we might recognize times when we have felt really challenged in our walk with Jesus too. And maybe we'll discover that the things the disciples didn't understand, we actually struggle to understand as well. So if you're still with me, will you travel back with me in time in this Mark's Mystery episode 6? And imagine you're watching this on a screen and the director fades from the opening shots of the men on the sea at night, the doo-dee-doo-doo-doo-dee-doo-doo, into a bright, bustling morning scene. And on the bottom of the screen, the day before. There's the sound of happy conversation, words tripping over each other, as we see the same group of men that we just saw gathered around Jesus, and this time they are talking animatedly. They're all chatting. Verse 30 tells us the disciples returned to Jesus and they told him all that they had done and taught. You see, the disciples have actually just got back from their first ever missions trip. Who's been on a missions trip before? A few people, maybe? Yep. Well, this was an epic missions trip. Earlier in another episode, in verse 7, Jesus had sent them out in twos to the surrounding villages to continue the work that they had actually seen him start to do, namely, proclaiming the need for repentance, casting out unclean spirits, and healing people. Quite heavy stuff for a first missions trip. And we're told that it was a successful time. This trip went really, really well. People responded to them. The disciples followed Jesus' instructions. They came back with all sorts of stories about what they'd seen happen. I don't know about you, but I can imagine the disciples' excitement and just kind of euphoria. You know, when you've had an amazing experience and there's been challenges, but there's been also like real success, you just want to tell all about it. And so I kind of am imagining the disciples being pretty upbeat. Oh man, Jesus, you should have seen the stuff that we did. But there's another bit of context here. Right after the disciples were sent out, Mark drops in, something that Mark likes to do, in the middle of something, a rather grisly story about the death of Jesus' cousin and colleague in ministry, John the Baptist. And you can read about it earlier in chapter 6. In a moment of weakness, King Herod has John beheaded in prison and actually serves the head up on a platter at a banquet. And then King Herod freaks out that what he hears about Jesus is actually John the Baptist, like, come back from the dead to haunt him. The story's, like I said, quite grisly, but it serves to remind us what we've already witnessed in Mark, which is that Jesus provokes opposition wherever he goes. And those who oppose him don't just want to kind of like quietly, you know, shut him up, keep him quiet. No, they actually want to kill him. And throughout Mark, there's this growing sense of underlying threat to Jesus, and also by inference to his followers. And the death of John the Baptist makes that suddenly explicit. So that's in the background too, as the disciples return and are talking to Jesus. So as they gather around Jesus, we have the sense of their excitement, maybe their confidence at the start of the day, but there's also this maybe a hint of grief and danger in the background. And I also suspect, and if you've been on a mission trip, you'd know, that the disciples were deep down dog tired. You know, they'd just actually had this huge time. Any kind of mission trip is really exhausting. And I imagine they're just actually really, really, really tired. And so in response to this situation, Jesus' words must have been a really welcome relief. Jesus recognizes this and he says to them, come away by yourselves to a desolate place. Some translations say isolated, deserted, you know, a place far away. Let's go away and rest a while. You know what? That would be good. Yes, Jesus, that sounds like a great idea. We'll do that. Verse 31 actually says that there were so many coming and going that the disciples didn't even have time to eat. Like, this really is like a busy kind of frenetic time. You can kind of see it. These weary disciples coming off a huge few days away are being invited by Jesus to leave the busyness, the press of all the people and the things to do, and to take a break in quietness and solitude. I really like that part. And I probably imagine the disciples did too. I think as they get ready and hop in the boat, I want us to imagine their anticipation at this point. A few weeks ago, Steve and I were given the opportunity and absolute blessing to go away for a couple of days to Hamner to stay in this like, beautiful home without our two young children, which was just amazing. It had been a Christmas gift and we'd been looking forward to it. But what I always notice when we get a chance to go away is how much I just really enjoy the journey to the destination. I don't know if you guys have this, but it's like when you are actually just leaving, you haven't got there yet, it's like, oh, this feels so great, I'm so excited. You know that you've got this time ahead of you and you start to just kind of feel relaxed just by the very act of like leaving things behind. Does anyone else have that? That's how I felt when we went to Hamner. It was like just in the car, this is awesome. I am just so happy and excited right now because of the anticipation. And this is how I picture the disciples, feeling relieved, knowing they're about to have a rest, just them and Jesus. You know, Jesus has been in hot demand. He wants to have just some time with them. No crowds, no pressure. Perhaps they might even be feeling a sense of self-importance as we hear people watch them go. Maybe they're thinking, we deserve this. We've worked hard. We're having a rest. So imagine their dismay, possibly even their horror, when they approach the shore and see that there is already a great crowd there. It seems from verse 33 that many had recognized them and had run on foot from all the towns and got ahead there ahead of them. Don't you think this would be an introvert's worst nightmare? It's like those moments when you like have a precious few, 5 minutes just to yourself, and like you're about to like pour your coffee or your tea or like plunge it. And then someone who urgently needs you like arrives at your door, or like your baby wakes up, or like colleague walks in, somebody interrupts your planned rest, and you only had that a much amount of time. It can be really hard to swallow. And for the disciples, I really don't think this is what they expected when they set out. It's like, the day has just taken a bit of a turn. And we're not actually told how the disciples reacted, but it's like they drop out of the story for the next bit. And that kind of makes me think maybe they didn't say or do very much. They hauled themselves out of the boat. But we are told how Jesus responds in verse 34. When he went ashore, he saw a great crowd, and he had compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd. And he began to teach them. I love this. I love how Jesus sees the people and his first response is one of compassion. And despite everything, despite the fact that this is supposed to be a rest time away, he starts to engage. He starts to engage the people. And I don't know what the disciples did, but kind of I imagine them when I read the story, like just going off and sitting under a tree perhaps and just like thinking, maybe we'll just wait, like wait it out until the crowds go away. I'll just see how long Jesus is going to take. You know, all these people are here. We'll just sit down here. But the problem is this. The crowds don't go away. We're told in verse 35 that it grew late. So late that the disciples, maybe like not all of them, maybe like a small delegation, finally come to Jesus and subtly remind him of his own words. This is a desolate place. And the hour is now late. It's late, Jesus. Send them away to go into the surrounding countryside and villages and buy themselves something to eat. Maybe it's because I tend towards impatience myself, just a teeny bit. But I kind of wonder if the disciples are feeling a bit impatient here, a bit frustrated. Like, this has gone on long enough. After all, playing in the background is probably the fact that this was supposed to be a rest day. So they have this really bright idea to like send the people away to get food. It sounds really noble. I do that sometimes. I've got this great idea, send them away to get food. But actually, I think it's probably an excuse just to like get rid of them. And Jesus calls them out on it. Not what they were wanting to hear. Jesus says, you give them something to eat. What? The disciples are rightly incredulous. Shall we go and buy 200 denarii worth of bread and give it to them to eat? That's about 8 months' worth of wages. A day laborer would get paid one denarii like a day, so 200, like 200 days' worth of working. It was like, that's way too much money, Jesus. Like, that's crazy. And again, this is not what they expected Jesus to say. It seems completely impossible, not to mention unreasonable. It's like their day just went from being kind of average or like moderately bad to being a whole lot worse. But Jesus is unfazed at their protests. He says, well, how many loaves do you have? Go and see. And here I just imagine, you know, the small group that's gone to talk to Jesus and like do the whole like Jesus send them away. They come back to the disciples under the tree. And I can just see them going, what did he say? Pete, what did he say? And the disciples having to say, you're not going to believe this, but he actually wants us to see how much food we've got because he wants us to feed them. Like, what? So I don't know what they do to look, whether they like rummage through their own bags or whether they go around asking others. The book of John has the story where they actually find a small boy who's got like a bit of food and that's what they do. Like, oh, we found this boy. But all we know here is that when they find out in verse 38, they go up to Jesus and they say, five and two fish. Now, I really like the humor in that detail. Jesus didn't say anything about finding fish, but it's like the disciples are like deliberately pointing to the ridiculousness of the situation. Five loaves is what we've got, Jesus. Oh, and look, we've got two fish. Isn't that good? It's going to go a long way. It's so obviously not enough. It's almost a joke. But Jesus takes command and tells them all to sit down on the grass. And taking the five loaves and the two fish, notice he doesn't waste the fish, people. He doesn't leave them out. He looks up to heaven. He said a blessing, and he broke the loaves and gave them to the disciples to set before the people. And he divided the two fish among them all. I love the way, despite their reluctance, Jesus still involves the disciples. He doesn't say, hey guys, you're not getting it. I've got this, just watch me. He says, no, you bring it to me, now you go and give it you go and give it. So he still involves the disciples with the little that they brought to him. And somehow, and I honestly wish the gospel writers were way more specific about this happened, somehow a great miracle takes place. As all eat and are satisfied. Not left like a little bit peckish, or you know, like just a wee bit hungry or whatever, but no, all are satisfied and there's more left over, and there were at least 5,000 people there. And you know, when I've heard this story in Sunday school, that's usually where the story ends, and you're like, wow, Jesus, that was really amazing. And the focus, as usual, falls on this amazing miracle, and rightly so. But actually, as we've seen today, the story doesn't end there. Not for the disciples, at least. Because after the disciples have been on pickup duty, so just imagine that. I don't know where they get the baskets, but they're like going around picking up all this bread, thinking, how did that happen? And they pick up the fish. Don't forget the fish. We read that the day is not over yet. Immediately, as soon as the disciples have finished picking up the food, Jesus makes them get into the boat and go before him to the other side, to Bethsaida, while he stays behind to dismiss the crowds. In other words, Jesus actually just sends the disciples away first, and they get no break. At least, that's how I read it. And I don't think this is what they had imagined or expected. And to make matters worse, Jesus sends them off into really difficult rowing conditions. It's not like he's like, go and have a row, it's going to be really pleasant, you know, nice night on the water. No, it's windy out there, and the wind is against them. And then Jesus stays behind. Mark tells us that when evening came, the boat was on the sea and he was alone on the land. And he saw that they were making headway painfully, for the wind was against them. And now we recognize the scene from the beginning. Ah, that's what's happened. That's what their day was like before the scene on the water. And when Jesus does finally appear to them, it's the fourth watch of the night. That is between 3 and 6 in the morning. They've been rowing a long time. And I think you could say that for the disciples, it's been a really long day and not the easiest. And it certainly hasn't been the one that they had expected when they set off with Jesus earlier that morning. And so when Jesus finally climbs into the boat, we read that the disciples were utterly astounded, for they didn't understand about the loaves, but their hearts were hardened. So I've been really thinking about this and wrestling and wondering what's been going on here. Why were the disciples' hearts hardened? What had happened in that day that had led them to harden their heart? And I think what we have here in Mark 6 is a picture of real discipleship. Not a happy, clappy, rosy picture, but a real, raw, rugged, this is what discipleship to Jesus sometimes looks like. And discipleship is one of Mark's really big themes. Many commentators have noticed how the disciples in Mark play a much more prominent role and are the focus of attention compared to the other Gospels. It seems that Mark is intensely interested in showing us the nature of real discipleship. What does it really look like to walk with Jesus day in and day out? And thankfully in Mark, it's not always a rosy picture. Mark's portrayal of these 12 men whom Jesus has called into relationship with him is often characterized as being two-edged. It's like they're put in a positive light, but also in a negative light. Like Mark's original audience, I think we're really supposed to relate to them. It's like we find ourselves in the disciples' story. So it's actually good news that they're not perfect, right? At least I think it's good news. Like, phew, I don't have to get it right all the time. And what we see in this particular episode is that following Jesus can sometimes be really challenging. It's like Jesus comes to us and challenges our notions of what an easy life, a kind of an easy walk with him might be like. Any kind of smug ideas we have about following Jesus, that it's just going to be really great and he's going to make me look really good, just doesn't cut it. Actually, following Jesus can feel hard. It can feel hard when you follow Jesus' direction, but then things don't turn out as you expect. And I feel like in my life, I've had a couple of moments like this. I remember when I had finished university, I was praying about my next step, and I felt really called to go and study at Teachers College and to do primary training. And it wasn't really on my radar at that time, but I really felt that that's actually what God revealed to me. And I had it confirmed through a number of other people. So I was like, okay, I'm going to step out in faith and I'm going to go and do this extra year of study and do primary training. And I moved to Wellington away from home to go and do it. And then at the end of the year, there were hardly any jobs that particular year. And so it was always like, a lot of people were thinking, I don't think they're going to pursue a job because there just weren't jobs out there. But I had two job openings from schools where I had an in, like they already knew me, and I was really encouraged to apply. And I felt this strong sense from God, this is what I want, I'm going to apply for these jobs. So I did it. And I had this kind of hopeful sense of expectation, God is leading me. And then I got two closed doors. Both schools said, sorry, we've filled the position. And I had to move back home and live with my mum because I didn't have a job. And it really wasn't what I had expected. And I wondered, God, did I hear wrong? Like, why did I step out and follow your direction and it hasn't worked out like I thought? And maybe some of you are sitting here thinking, yeah, I know a time. Like, maybe you've stepped out in faith, you've followed the direction of the Lord, and you did something new and you thought it was going to lead to blessing and that's what Jesus was going to do. And then all you've got has been like blood, sweat, and tears, and it's not worked out like you thought. That can feel really hard. It can feel hard when you sense God is asking you to do something and you feel like you just don't have what it takes. When you're faced with a real need, like these people need to be fed, and you don't have it, you feel like provision is impossible. Like, God, I just can't do it. I've had times where I've had like a mountain of things to do and I've just thought, Jesus, I just actually just can't do it. Like, it's just impossible. And those times feel really hard, especially again when you feel like, I've just been following you, Jesus. And the story today, everything the disciples did was following Jesus. It wasn't their idea to go and have a break. It wasn't their idea to get in the boat. It was Jesus. They're following his initiative. Yet things just didn't quite go how they thought. And it can feel really hard when you just can't see, like the disciples, what God is doing. What is he doing in your life? What is he doing in my life? Why have things worked out like they have? Like the disciples, we can feel perplexed and just like we don't understand. So I wonder, what did the disciples miss? What did they miss? Now that we've seen the whole story of the day before, what was it that they hadn't understood? And what is it that we struggle to understand? Just a couple of things. I think the first thing that the disciples probably didn't understand is that it's not actually about them. When Jesus calls us to base our life on him, to put him in the center and pursue a relationship with him, it means that life is no longer about us, right? It pains me to say it, but it's true. Doing life with Jesus is not about our comfort and our ease or about having everything work out perfectly. And that's a really challenging and hard thing for some of us to hear. Jesus' message in life was never actually about making our lives easy. But we really want it to be easy. It's pretty much what all parents are complaining about when they have small children, is that it's just not easy. I just wish it was. But in reality, the good news is that we are no longer in the center, and Jesus wants us to be free from life needing to be all about us. And instead, what I think the disciples might have missed in this moment, or particularly like in the presence of that moment, there's a comment that makes it seem like maybe disciples later on got it, is that Jesus is always about the people. He's the good shepherd. Even when he's tired and it's not in the plan, he's about the crowds that don't know him. He's about the crowds that are like sheep without a shepherd, who are not being cared for, who are not being led, those that are aimless and bedraggled. There's that beautiful image of Jesus as the good shepherd. You know, again, he's there. He wants to feed them. He wants to care for them. That's where his heart is. And that's, I think, where he wants our hearts to be as well. So I think the disciples were on a bit of a journey to realize that actually it wasn't about them. And the second thing, which is really the big one for Mark, the bit that the disciples haven't yet quite understood, is to do with who Jesus is. The first half of Mark is totally focused really around one question. Who is he? Who is Jesus? what is his identity? And everything that's happened so far is all about trying to answer that question. And we've seen that the only people so far that are getting it are like, the only claim about who Jesus is coming from demons. And Jesus is like, shh, don't tell. Now we realize even his disciples haven't quite got it. There are some clues in the story, though, for us about who Jesus is. They've been there all through Mark. Clues that the disciples in the moment didn't seem to get, but Mark, I think, wants us and his readers to see. The whole setting of the feeding story serves to remind us that Jesus is the Messiah and the King over all things. He is completely sovereign over the natural world, bread and fish, wind and waves. It's interesting, his seemingly insignificant detail about sitting on the green grass, did you hear that when I read it, the green grass? That in verse 39 lets us know that this is taking place in spring, and spring is Passover time. So for the Jews there gathered, it's Passover time, and Jesus feeding in the desert, or not in the desert, but in this particular place, is a hearkening back to the way God fed his people in the desert after he brought them up out of Egypt. But even more, it foreshadows another Passover when Jesus will again take bread and break it. But this time, it will represent his body broken for us. And it seems that Mark for sure wants his readers and us living on this side of Easter and the resurrection to make that connection between Jesus' actions. He's the one who, he's taking the bread, he's blessing it, he's lifting it up. This is what he's going to do on the night that he's betrayed. So I think that really what you'd have to say is that the disciples haven't understood who Jesus is, and they haven't yet quite understood that Jesus is doing something completely new. That he is inaugurating a new creation. He's recreating a new kingdom with a new kind of king. It's kind of funny that we've just had that little bit about Herod in the middle of the story, because unlike Herod, who is off throwing parties for the elite, chopping the head of the prophet off just to save face, Jesus is a king who is with the common people. He's taking common food and he's multiplying it to provide a banquet for a hungry crowd. And as he organises the folk to sit down in groups, which some people have thought could be a slight military reference, they're sitting down in groups of 150, it's not a sign of organising armies to go out to war, but it's an organising of friends and strangers to share a meal. It's a sign of a new kingdom breaking in through Jesus. So where does that leave us today as I close? I'm wondering, given where we're at today, what is Jesus wanting to speak to us from this episode? If we're being asked by Mark to think about the disciples' reaction at the end of the story, then how should we respond? And the first thing I wanted to say is that it's okay if you feel a bit like the disciples this morning. Maybe you too are struggling with things you don't understand. Maybe you're struggling with unmet expectations. You might feel perplexed about what Jesus is up to in your life and how he's going about it. Things are not going as you expected. And if that's you, I think the invitation is to recognize where you're feeling challenged in your discipleship journey and then bring that to Jesus. It's okay to ask questions and to express our frustration. You're in good company with the disciples. But I think we also have a choice today. Because unlike the disciples, in that particular moment, we know where the story is going, right? We know in a way that they didn't yet realize that Jesus' ultimate purpose is to suffer for us, to lay down his life and rise again. And with that full revelation of all that Jesus is and why he came, we have a choice. Will we harden our hearts when there are things we don't understand? Or will we respond in faith? And I think that's the antidote to a hard heart that we see in Mark. Jesus is often looking for faith and for trust. And it's faith and trust in him that will keep our hearts soft, unlike the disciples in that moment. So I just wanted to take a minute just to be still and quiet and just to give you a chance to just listen to maybe what God wants to say to you from the story. That's kind of what I felt to bring. So we'll just take a minute and then I'll pray us out.